This podcast is exclusively sponsored by Equalend, a global fintech firm for the securities finance industry.
All right, all right, all right. Welcome back to Asia Securities Finance Monthly. And as always, this is your overly caffeinated host, Matt MacArthur from Hong Kong. Coming up on the show today, we take a deep dive into the fixed income universe with Vladimir Gogolitsyn from Standard Chartered. And
it's a very hot topic right now with the elections and everything going through the roof in that space.
Find out what's going on in the world of securities finance recruiting with our very own Jerry Maguire, Mr. Craig Fowler. Now, let's be honest. This podcast provides me with beachfront property to talk about topical issues that affect all of us here in APAC. But I will tell you, at all of the PASLA and Equalend networking events, I inevitably get suggestions on topics or guests. Usually, it centers around replacing the host. But the second most requested topic is fixed income. Now, I've done my 10,000 hours on the equity side, and I'll do something that I very rarely do in life, which is be honest. Fixed income is still a total blind spot for me. But thankfully, we have with us today Vladimir Gogolitsyn from Standard Chartered. Welcome to the podcast, Vlad.
What an intro. Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Matt.
Now, I know that Standard Chartered has a huge fixed income presence in APAC, but it might be better to start off with the basics. What is fixed income, repo, corporates, and how far down the credit chain do we go? Basically, can you turn myself and the audience into a fixed income specialist and say maybe the next 5 minutes? You can do that, right?
Absolutely. Well, I'll certainly try my best. So I'm the head of Asia Repo for Standard Chartered Bank, and we tend to specialize in fixed income here in Singapore. So the main things to remember in fixed income repo is that the participants tend to be fixed income asset owners. So it's financial institutions in most cases, although corporates have started to participate more frequently through cash investment programs, and these tend to be very short dated in nature, even as little as overnight. But that's a nice segue into the tenors in repo. So the fixed income repo market tends to be rather short tenor. ICMA surveys estimate something like 92% of volume is sub 3 months in tenor. So in fixed income, it tends to be very short dated. Of course, there can be much longer transactions, but these tend to be bespoke and not usually transacted under JIMRA, which is the standard master legal agreement that governs fixed income repo. There are markets in credit all the way down the curve. And of course, in high yield space, it's where it gets really, really interesting. As for example, there's lots of short interest in distressed markets, such as we saw in Sri Lanka dollar bonds over the last couple of years, where the repo borrow becomes very expensive. The reasons the market is so large, broad, and rich is because opportunities exist for it to be a really useful tool for many of the participants in the market. Post the Basel III regulatory landscape, so Basel III is the Basel Accords, which meant that banks have to hold capital against a lot of their positions. And this regulation has meant that in the fixed income market, repo is used to help with meeting those metrics. So as well as a funding tool to obtain leverage and gain liquidity, asset owners can enhance returns through securities lending programs. And there's a very rich landscape where optimization for collateral and funding and capital ratios. As a very simple example, we have the concept of HQLA, which is high quality liquid assets in fixed income, which is a regulatory definition. That tends to be developed market government bonds. Because of operational and cross-border differences, my HQLA may not be the same as your HQLA, and therefore we can optimize between us. And so our market has sprung up for this. And of course, broader market liquidity is helped enormously by repo markets, because repo can be used to mitigate settlement fails as well.
Now, that is a perfect download. But when I think of funding trades, I think of the mother of all funding trades, the cross-currency basis trade, which is essentially a U.S. Treasury versus Japanese government bond, ARB, meaning borrow cheap currency in Japan, then use that capital to buy USD, then reinvest those proceeds into something more higher yielding. Is that trade still popular?
Yes, very much so. In fact, we saw a lot of commentary about it after the BOJ hike at the end of July in the summer, which was a surprise to many, given that rates have been low for so long in yen. Around the time, I remember reading articles where it was estimated that around $1 trillion US dollar equivalent of assets are sourced by Japanese investors and invested into the US dollar, which, if true, is a very large number. Comparatively, the entire UST repo market is estimated at roughly somewhere around 4.3 trillion US dollars, according to SIFMA. Now, that would indicate a very large participation in this carry trade. And so, therefore, there's a huge amount of volume being transacted in this already.
I guess the natural follow-up question is, what's the evolution of the cross-currency basis trade in the past 12 months, and where's it going? I mean, I know the borrowing rates in Japan were zero, and then neg 10, and now plus 5. Clearly, the yen has strengthened. What I'm saying is, how volatile can these funding trades be?
Yeah, very good question. They're incredibly volatile. Market volatility in the currency has meant lots of collateral repricing. Bear in mind that if you use cross-currency in order to fund yourself in yen, you're exposed to the spot rate. And so as the spot rate changes, your collateral value goes up and down, which can sometimes cause a downward spiral where the value of your collateral drops in contrast to the currency that you've borrowed against, for example, US dollar in this case. So as that reprices, collateral values cause a reshuffle in the bond market, and some participants have to borrow more collateral in order to deliver into their margin calls. However, we've been really impressed with how resilient the repo market has been throughout all of these movements, even throughout the various crises in 23 with various bank collapses, and in March 20 with COVID, spreads widened, but prices didn't freeze anywhere near to the same extent as we saw in September 2008. We're going to be watching with interest what the BOJ does over the next year or so, and whether we'll see the evolution of rates and what it means for the very popular yen carry trade. Recent headlines this week suggest that the central bank is on a hiking trajectory, whereas a lot of DM markets still seem to be in easing mode. So we're going to be watching next year with interest.
Now, shifting gears, Korean Treasury bonds, also known as KTBs, has been one of the standout funding trades in the past. Can you explain why this is? And what are the main drivers?
In the KTB market especially, the main driver has been that KTBs are seen as a reliable credit with very attractive yields. And it's as simple as that. In my world, I consider SGS, that's Singapore government bonds, in a very similar vein, where the yields are very attractive relative to the creditworthiness of the collateral. And the collateral is seen as good quality, and it can be used as a diversifier with margin baskets. For example, where a lot of your margin baskets have to insist on several different issuers, but still insist on a specific credit rating, you can use numerous issuers in order to deliver into that margin basket. Of course, we're very happy with the increased market access, especially in Asia, and cheered loudly when ICSDs announced KTB eligibility, and it was wonderful to see flow there. There is some work to do, as there are still some hurdles and issues persist with rehypothecability, that is, the ability to reuse a bond once it's been lent. Coupon handling, I appreciate that that's not a problem that equities specialists face, and domestic participants are still not participating in the market in ICSDs. But, you know, there's always room to grow, and we look forward to broadening and development of those markets.
Now, when you say ICSDs, I presume you're talking something along the lines of Euroclear, which in theory, they've recently made it easier to trade KTBs. To what extent, I'm not really sure. Any color on that?
Yes, absolutely. So Euroclear, Clearstream, JP Morgan and Boney are international CSDs. So that's depositories that handle collateral on behalf of others. And it's very nice to see the ICSDs develop markets, especially in regional markets. Of course, there are restrictions for Asian markets, and in Korean won in particular, there's restrictions on how convertible Korean won is offshore. And so as a result, they've had to navigate around that very complicated regulatory matrix in Asia, particularly. But it's very nice to see them doing work on developing all of the infrastructure that is necessary to help international investors buy into regional markets, including Korea.
Now, why does China, just to pick a random APAC example, want to grow the bond market? What would be the advantages of a growing fixed income market?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of regional treasurers and regulators are recognizing the power and usefulness of repo for liquidity management, amongst other things. If you're a sovereign issuer, deep and liquid repo markets really help primary issuance and the broader market. And as I mentioned earlier, market makers are unable to quote fails prevention, smoother liquidity, temporary liquidity. And with respect to China in particular, we're really encouraged by the PBOC consultations on the issue, as we see it as a sign of regulator willingness to increase the amount of participants in response to demand. We look to partner with PASLA and other trade associations for help with this. Of course, regulators are keen to make sure that rules are followed and leverage is not excessive. We understand the need to make sure that joining two distinct markets with their own conventions is not easy to do overnight. For example, the main product in China repo is pledge rather than title transfer, as is more common in more developed markets. There's no margining. The legal agreements do not use the JIMRA, but instead use the NAFMI agreement. And how the default process is treated is also slightly separate. So joining those two markets together is difficult, but we try our best to make sure to use trade bodies to help us along with that.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but to me, the million-dollar question would be, how do we increase the secondary market liquidity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question. The best thing I would probably recommend is to encourage participation as much as possible and try and reduce fragmentation and devices that prevent access to markets. So harmonization of legal agreements is really, really useful. The legal opinions on netting provide more space for other participants to join the market and things like that. So, you know, a repo market is, I think, recognized by regulators and issuing treasurers as being incredibly useful. And in fact, you know, we're seeing the base rates curves, the fallback curves become secured, you know, and the prime example in the US dollar space is, you know, the world is moving away from LIBOR and into SOFA, which is a repo based index. So I think it's clear to a lot of regulators and market participants that repo is an incredibly useful tool. And I think the secondary liquidity comes as a benefit of that for a lot of corporate issuers. And of course, if they have deep and liquid repo markets, primary issuance is helped out by that process as well. So yeah, it's very interesting to see. Nice to see the market growing.
Now, from a macro perspective, fixed income volume in APAC, are we still in the developmental stage? I realize in turn, naturally, that creates higher spreads due to less liquidity. But my question is, for how long are we still in the developmental stage?
Well, I'd like here to respectfully disagree with you, Matt. I don't think we are in the developmental stage. In fact, estimates of the onshore China repo market put the volume around $1 trillion equivalent. So I would argue it's moved past the developmental stage at that size. Of course, there are still limitations to liquidity and access. Perfection in all markets is still very much a goal. We're even seeing in the US market, UST clearing being introduced. So it's clear that the regulators see some need for changing the market as it is. Of course, there's limitations to liquidity, access, perfection in all markets, even in developed ones like we're seeing with USTs introducing clearing and regulators trying to help markets there. It's still a goal rather than the end state. And yes, there are definitely regional markets in Asia where for a number of reasons why that fragmentation still exists. Various Asia markets are at stages of market adoption, where the juice has simply not been worth the squeeze to develop repo. For example, in some regional markets, cash is still king and used as margin, which seems hideously inefficient for European or US participants who I guess are further along in their repo journey. And of course, there's the market control and regulatory desire. We've seen in DM markets post 2008 substantial changes in regulation. And the equivalent in Asia would be the 97 crisis, where perhaps allowing additional uncontrolled leverage is not seen as being a beneficial enough trade-off versus the benefit of market liquidity and repo. But as always, thankfully, we are seeing this change with ICSD market adoption, China Repo Connect looking more promising for the next year. We look forward to the market being less fragmented and are obviously helped to partner with our clients and systems platforms to help us achieve that.
Now, this is my last question, and it might just be pie in the sky thinking, but is there a company, sort of like what Equilend does for lending rates, who independently rates the underlying lenders so banks can use them as a standard grading metric for risk-weighted average purposes?
So, well, that's one of the most interesting aspects of repo is the pricing. The price is different depending on who asks. Because of Basel III regulations mean that capital has to be held against each trade, and we call that RWA, risk-weighted assets. This is why it's so difficult to get reliable indices for credit repo, because the price changes depending on who asks, and the matrix of collateral and counterparty is very, very difficult to sometimes reconcile. And even across different banks, because counterparty ratings might be different, the price of a repo might be different by bank. So it varies across bank, counterparty, and credit grade of the collateral. It's very interesting. Because the repo market is so useful for this, it helps to reduce RWA. Repo still remains a really RWA-friendly product because it's self-collateralizing, under Jimbra it's daily margined, and the collateral, because of the repo market, is very easily liquidated. It's seen as a very useful tool for banks to help optimize their RWA and their capital more broadly, not to mention how to optimize their margin.
So, Vlad, let me see if I can digest this. As an amateur, you're telling me it's basically pricing is a matrix that sits on top of a seesaw that can change as the wind changes. Is that my takeaway?
Well, I don't think it's as much dependent on the weather, perhaps if we exclude catastrophe bonds out of that picture. But various counterparties, because of the credit variance of counterparties, it does make sense for prices to be different for banks that have sensitivity to the capital that they hold by transaction. So as I say, that's why it's difficult to get a reliable investment grade credit index. However, having said that, it's, you know, such an index exists, like, for example, iTraxx in the credit bond market. So maybe it's going to be possible in the future to have a tool or an industry platform of sorts that will help with counterparty ratings. Of course, it's very easy if your counterparty happens to be a large bank and it tends to issue bonds so that you can tell the credit rating from its senior issuance. But for a lot of smaller market participants and non-public funds in particular, and including some sovereigns, it's very difficult to gauge creditworthiness. And so bank risk departments have to do it independently. And lastly, of course, there's variance in regulation across jurisdictions. So it's certainly a fun puzzle to work out. But, you know, in all of those cases, it's easy enough for the repo to help out with that because it can optimize across collateral where perhaps clean lending doesn't make as much sense as a repo would.
Vlad, that was tremendous. Informational and educational. Exactly what we were looking for. You have officially made this podcast great again. Thank you very much for your time.
Matt, thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Asia Securities Finance Monthly returns after this short break.
Registration is now open for the 2025 PASLA Conference on Asian Securities Finance in Macau. Join us February 26th and 27th for 2 days of carefully curated sessions with engaging speakers, deep dives into the key themes impacting our industry, and a look ahead to 2025. Register now for your space via the new PASLA event portal. We look forward to seeing you in Macau.
We here in the creative department of this podcast are always searching for new ways to add value for the listener. And as you know, we usually interview business development leaders or securities lending traders themselves. But today, we're mixing things up a little. Our next guest is the finance industry's recruitment leader for equities jobs in Hong Kong, Craig Fowler from Fowler International, right here in Hong Kong. Welcome to the podcast, Craig.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be invited.
Now, Craig, you are excellent at a few things. Maybe not fantasy football, but you do have contacts at every major hedge fund in APAC, every top-tier investment bank, all of the boutique banks, even custody banks. Is there anyone you don't cover?
Yeah, having been here for a long time, coming up to 15 years now, you make a lot of friends, and yeah, the network is vast.
Now, talk to me about some of the talent trends and any major shifts that you're seeing in APAC.
I mean, there's been a lot of shifts and a lot of changes from the time that I came out here and started covering equity finance and SBL in these areas. People will always say that there's a juniorization. I'm just not sure if that's just you and I getting older. Previously, I would say desks were covered maybe region by region, very relationship-driven, a mixture of seniorities. And as time has kind of changed and people have moved on into, whether it's leaving the country or moved into other industries or moving sell-side, buy-side, there's definitely been kind of a change of what desks require, what people look at, what skills that they feel that people need to be hiring for.
How did COVID affect the talent availability? And have we normalized finally?
It's an interesting one, actually, because during COVID, I had three of my best years. I definitely don't think that there was a shortage of revolving doors, turnover, where people were leaving. That gave other people opportunities. And there was definitely chances for people to step up in levels of seniority and take on bigger positions. And yeah, I don't think it necessarily had a negative impact other than clearly a lot of our friends and a lot of contacts did leave. But I definitely don't think that the desks suffered from it from a talent perspective. Historically, people that would come from, you know, Australia, UK, US, all around, that would always be a two-way street. Now, yes, potentially that has slowed up somewhat. And I don't get people from London, let's say, for instance, calling me regularly saying, hey, I'm a 24, 25-year-old person and I'm desperate to come out to Hong Kong or to Singapore. That being said, internal moves, internal transfers, I think is returning. And I think more talent is coming, whether it's secondment or, you know, doing their 4 or 5 year stint in Asia. I believe that is coming back post-COVID.
Craig, any cultural shift that you've seen in the last, say, decade in Asia?
Interesting one. I definitely think that candidates, people that are on the desk day to day, they have a different prioritization when it comes to what I saw when I first moved out here, which was very much a hustler mentality. Everyone was trying to get to the top spot, the top bank. We're always thinking about what's the best business card that they can get their hands on and be proud to be working from that bank. People have stepped back and taken a little bit more balance in, okay, so is that still the most important thing in my life, fighting up the chain and working for, you know, as much money as I can and this sort of stuff. So there's definitely more of a work-life balance angle in what people look for in a job themselves. And not only that, but you also see within a bank, there's definitely been changes where the power has shifted. And so everyone has to be very careful and compliant and always be kind of watching out for anything that could be coming back to, as I said, compliance. And so managers have to always be aware of how they run their teams in a very controlled manner in that regard, where it's not like the Wild West of back in the 70s and 80s type stuff. That's definitely shifted since then. Another point that I definitely wanted to raise is, and it's a very hot topic right now with the elections and everything going through the roof in that space, is the digital asset world. And how many people from within our realm have made that move and transition over to offering people financing leverage. And it's because it's a very close skill set that's transitionable across to the crypto world, to digital asset world. And I would certainly say that, yeah, the talent universe, that we've lost some great people to that side, to the dark side. So it maybe might mean that there's a shrinking talent pool, because could be 8 to 10% of the Hong Kong market moved across and gave it a go in that world, and most of which have done phenomenally well.
Is there any particular shortage of skill set?
Interesting question, and I will kind of flip reverse that one, where I think that there's been a slightly enlarged priority on people with technical skills and technical abilities. As I said, historically, it was languages, people that speak Chinese, people that speak Korean, people that speak Japanese, all of those things. Now it's coding abilities, coding languages. And there might sometimes be an overfocus on these areas where the softer side of the industry is still crucial. Relationship management and being able to, you know, do the client aspect and, you know, speaking to the lenders and that side of things. And I think that has been deprioritized and is something that is still crucial in the business. So I think that as a blend of a team, you need all of these different skills across the remit of your team.
Well, oddly enough, you just nailed my next question, which was supposed to be, what's the recruitment profile?
What you're good at.
Yeah, which is very little, might I add. I was wondering that the recruitment profile for securities finance, has that changed over the decades? But I guess you mentioned it's more tech focused now. But what are the key demands for recruiters now, like yourself?
From a hiring manager standpoint, definitely they are looking for, you know, whether it's fresh grads or people coming off a VIE program, or they want them to be more technical than previously. And one trend that I've definitely seen over the last 10 years is that sometimes it's not sustainable, because someone comes in as a SBL trader and they're a coding wizard, they're not going to be sat at the desk wanting to do that role longer term. They're either going to want to move into the desk next door, index arbitrage, or doing, you know, more risk involved roles. Not only that, but the buy side has ended up morphing and looking more and more like banks as we move forward. And they are attracting a lot of people across into that space. So I've seen, you know, people ending up onto the huge hedge fund platforms, people, you know, even being able to become junior portfolio managers themselves and running books. So I do think that there's a slight void between what hiring managers think they need and what is actually longer term sustainable. Historically, a lot of people used to come out of trade support and out of middle office and be given these opportunities to get their dream job as being an SBL trader or equity finance. And I don't see that happening as much. It does happen, but not as much. And I do think that if you give someone that opportunity from coming from internally, giving them a step up into the front office type trading functions, that you will gain more loyalty and more longevity of service from talent and from individuals.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, Craig, this is a question I get all the time. So if I get it, you must get it daily. Can you take somebody from outside of finance and drop them into our world?
I think hiring managers would be afraid of putting their name on the line and wouldn't be willing to take that risk. The trends that have happened is everyone's going for a safe bet of hiring someone that has a perfect looking CV. Do I think that that always works? No. Have I been able to get people that have come from lateral, you know, different ideas because I think that they have some extra spice and a personality that's going to get them, that they just have it and they've got the hustle and the grit and determination? Yes, I do think that that is possible. Does it happen very often anymore? No.
Now, this is me just asking for a friend. How do candidates or even random podcast hosts increase their marketability or value add to their current and potential future employers? I think the buzzword a few years ago was manage up, but I guess I'm wondering, is it really just about volunteering yourself and getting more involved in all aspects of the business to kind of raise your profile?
100%. I mean, that's something that I get from the more senior management that come back to me with feedback, whether it's someone that I've placed or just generally talking about their teams and their business, that, yeah, that person that's willing to go the extra mile, but not only that, also never drop the ball on their day-to-day is crucial. If you want to be promoted, already be doing the job before you get promoted, but make sure you don't leave behind what you also are supposed to be doing. I think that's where people come unstuck, and I get frustrated when I get certain phone calls where they're like, I think I'm better than this and I need to get out of here. And you hear feedback from their bosses and they say they're not doing anything. They're being lazy and they're not delivering on their day-to-day tasks. So I think that that's definitely the go the extra mile, I think is the right way to kind of think about it.
Craig, my last question, and I'm sure it's not exactly Pulitzer worthy, but talent accumulation is hugely important. It's really the lifeline of any major company, but talent retention is often overlooked. How are firms doing to retain, or what are they doing to retain staff, effectively making your job harder?
Yeah, I mean, people need to be promoted on the right time frame within the balance of a team. You can't all of a sudden turn the pyramid upside down and be too top heavy. Internal mobility, giving people opportunities to move into the next thing they want. And as I said, that can be whether it's a middle office person moving into the front office trading, whether it's that superstar SBL trader that has coding knowledge and being able to move them on to keep the system moving and flowing, and making sure you pay your mid to junior ranking staff so that they're not always taking the calls and looking over their shoulder, oh, there's a better pay grade and I'm being underpaid because I'm getting 10% increments on a too lower level from the first instance. And if I leave and move, I get 30 to 40% up. I definitely think that paying people market rate is the key.
Craig, thanks again for a peek behind the curtain, and I appreciate your time as always.
Thanks a lot.
We'd love to hear your feedback. If you have any questions or comments about topics you've heard on the show, please drop us an email at podcast@paslaonline.com. That's it for this edition of Asia Securities Finance Monthly. I'm Matt MacArthur in Hong Kong. Join us next month for more updates and analysis.
This podcast is exclusively sponsored by Equiland, a global fintech firm for the securities finance industry.